Welcome to an enlightening podcast from IslamPodcasts.com. We encourage our listeners to please comment and let us know how we can grow in our knowledge to better serve our community. Please remind your family and friends to also visit IslamPodcasts.com for engaging discussions on current events, Islamic guidance, Quran, tafsir, seerah, and much more. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Podcasts on current events, Islamic guidance, Quran tafsir, and seerah are available at islampodcasts.com as well as on iTunes. Rate, review, and comment and let us know how we can grow in our knowledge to better serve our community. Please subscribe, share, and tell a friend about islampodcasts.com as well as rate, review of iTunes.
A warm welcome to any non-Muslim participants in the audience. We would like to thank you for taking out your time to listen to this speech. Now, I was given the topic, Women in Islam Beyond the Stereotypes. I could have gone many different ways with this topic and taken many different approaches. I came with the view of addressing Muslims as well as non-Muslims today, so I hope that will be appreciated and illustrated for you. Alright, so repressed, oppressed, enslaved and inferior to men, only to be used for their own whims and desires. These and many more of the like are synonymous when it comes to describing the position of the woman in Islam. When the terms sharia and woman are coupled together, an image of a second-class burqa-wearing citizen conjures to mind. Now, despite the countless clarifications from many Islamic bodies and notables from the community, the main misconceptions still prevail and remain the dominant feature when attributed to the Muslim woman. The same old, unenlightening, boring, I might add, rhetoric has been used and overused by many politicians and media commentators alike. I'm not sure if you remember Senator Corey Benardi. Anyway, he's a South Australian senator who described the burqa as being the most public feature of fundamentalist Islam, and that we need to stop the expansion of this fundamentalist Islam in Australia lest we lose the foundation, the essence, the very culture of our great nation. A few years back, there were calls by Liberal politician Bronwyn Bishop to ban the hijab in state schools as a result in a clash of cultures, and it can be used as a sort of iconic item of defiance. What I find baffling to the point of it being laughable is that the West aims to monopolise the moral high ground when it comes to asserting women's rights and to be some sort of beacon of light that Muslim women should and must aspire to. It is assumed that Western secular liberalism is a universal value that all societies wish to ascribe to and live by in attempts to revitalise their respective societies in order for progress to occur. Women's liberation movements and the feminist theory have been used as a barometer to gauge whether or not women in other societies meet up to the perceived standard within which Western women apparently possesses. Try as they may, more and more Muslim women have rejected this view and will proclaim loudly that Islam accommodates all her needs and then some. Despite these many attempts to demonise Islam by politicians here and abroad, there has been a rise in converts to Islam. Many of them who, which is a point that needs to be emphasised, are actually women. A recent study by Swansea University in the UK found that in the past 10 years, out of the 100,000 new converts to Islam, three quarters of them were women, with the average age of 27. Now, I want to address what the main stereotypes are that are being perpetrated by the society at large. There are two that encompass the mainstream of stereotypes labeled at the Muslim woman. The first being that the woman in Islam is oppressed and needs to be liberated from the shackles that her religion imposes on her. And the second, that Muslim women are denied the notion of freedom of choice and make no independent decisions where issues such as education, marriage, lifestyle, and even dress are concerned. Now, concerning the first point, when America invaded Afghanistan with its allies, one of its main justifications, besides trying to combat terrorism, was also to liberate Afghani women from the Taliban rule. The Taliban in Afghanistan is painted by the West as a very embodiment of what happens when Sharia law is implemented in a society practically. Women do not have access to an education, the stoning of women being a common punitive measure, women being sidelined in society and do not contribute in the day-to-day dealings of public life. These connotations have become synonymous whenever Sharia law is mentioned and as an alternative governing body. And the term Islamic law is often misapplied to describe many of the governing bodies we have in the Muslim world today that stifle many rights that the Muslim women are in fact afforded to by Islam. Islam has often gained recognition as a common denominator to all these injustices against women, but even just a brief study of its rules would highlight that the actions are abhorrent to the religion itself. They result from non-Islamic tribal or traditional common cultural practices of communities. In addition, these practices have been provided fertile ground to grow and flourish by dictatorial, incompetent regimes that currently plague the Muslim world. These governments have turned a blind eye to these heinous traditional customs, allowing many crimes to go unpunished. Furthermore, they have directly instigated injustices against women. Women face dire poverty, poor access to education, healthcare, employment opportunities, and political rights. Some of these states have been associated with Islam, but a closer look at their ruling structures, laws, constitutions show them to be just monarchies, tribal systems, secular dictatorships or republics. Structures that places sovereignty of the law in the hands of the human being, a complete contradiction to Islam itself, where sovereignty belongs to the Creator alone, with laws extracted purely from Islamic texts. In contrast, the rights prescribed to women within the Islamic texts are very clear. The right to education, employment, to vote, political participation, choice in marriage and the right to divorce, the rights of citizenship, on par with the men of society, and importantly, the right to respect and the protection of her life and honour. However, unlike Western societies where women often had to battle the system to secure their rights, the rights afforded to women in the societies of Islamic history were dependent upon Islamic rule, the Khilafah system. When the application of this system weakened, or worse, was removed from existence in 1924, then these rights were not guaranteed, and Muslim women fell prey to the grave injustices of these tribal customs, autocratic regimes, and incorrect interpretations and misapplications of the Islamic text. Secondly, the whole notion of freedom of choice and how Islam does not allow the woman to make arbitrary decisions concerning day-to-day choices that concern how she wants to live her life. I will say unequivocally that Islam has placed certain prescriptions as to how an individual should conduct themselves in society in their capacity as a citizen of a state, a son, a daughter, a mother, a father, a husband, a wife, a neighbour, a businessman, a politician, etc. So when a Muslim woman makes a decision, such as wearing the hijab as part of her dress, it is seen by the wider society as an imposition on her to wear it, and it is not our choice. I would argue otherwise, because given that we live in a society that affords its citizens to utilise this freedom of choice, I could just as easily walk out the door without my scarf on, knowing very well that I will be exercising my freedom of choice. I will be protected by the state apparatus and laws if indeed I decided to make that decision. But as a Muslim woman, I believe that my Creator knows what is the best for me and has outlined specifically as to how I gain His pleasure. Therefore, the opinion of my Creator and what He thinks of me far outweighs what people think of me. This is a choice that I myself have chosen to make. This concept of freedom of choice is at the core of Western liberal values. The West would argue, quite arrogantly, that anything that goes against the grain of this value is to be made void and redundant and labelled oppressive. Now, what has this notion really brought for women in reality, this notion of freedom of choice? Is it really a choice for a mother when she has to choose whether her being at home with the children, finding it very hard to make ends meet, then work so she can provide food and shelter for her family? Is it really a choice when the police made a public community-wide notice for women to avoid walking alone at night as a sexual predator was on the loose and their protection was not guaranteed? When looking at some of these laws pertaining to women under Sharia, they are often looked at in isolation and not as part of a whole comprehensive system that serves not to meet just the needs of women, but all of its citizens. Hence, the laws pertaining to women are often skewed and taken out of context. When will the wider society be happy with the status of women in Islam? At what point will it be considered that we hold equal rank to our supposed liberated counterparts? When could we conform to social norms? Participate more in the wider society, perhaps? The fact of the matter is, we tick all the boxes when it comes to the above. The Muslim women live and participate in society in more ways than one. We go to school, university, enter the workforce, attend social functions, attend PNC meetings at schools. We do as much as any other woman living in society. So if we do that, why do we always feel like we're always constantly under the microscope? Isn't it enough that we do all these things that the average citizen also engages in? The attack on women in Islam is part of a whole assimilationist effort in the West, cloaked in terms such as social cohesion or multiculturalism. They want Muslims to accept the status quo, even if it means turning a blind eye to atrocities committed by this government abroad and not to hold them in any way account. They want a diluted version of Islam that is not antagonistic to their foreign policies, but want a version of Islam that works within the confines of Western secular liberalism, not as a challenge to its authority or supremacy. Now, these assimilationist policies are not unique to Muslims. It was utilised on the first wave of Greek and Italian immigrants, and also immigrants from Asia such as China and Vietnam. The difference is, when it comes to Islam, is that only Islam can provide a real and lasting challenge to secular liberalism. They see it as a threat to the West's hegemony over the Muslim world and her interests. The West's attack on women in Islam is because of what we represent. And I would have to argue with Bronwyn Bishop here when she says that the hijab is an iconic act of defiance. The Muslim woman has held on to her identity despite the enormous pressure of the wider society to conform to a certain standard pertaining to women. She preserves her honour and refuses to allow others to dictate what she can and can't wear. It is in essence this piece of cloth that infuriates the West, as it is a testament to her unshakable conviction that is in her Creator. This stands as the building block of a strong and resilient Ummah, a connection with her Muslim brothers and sisters worldwide, in addition to her own individual worth. The very fact that I stand here before you today addressing this issue validates the West's obsession with women and in Islam, and is symptomatic of their overall obsession with women in general. An obsession that is a product of the inherent patriarchal structures in Western societies. Be it through the media, advertising and pop culture, the woman is used as an object to further perpetuate the base desires in men. Patriarchal structures are still alive and kicking, even in the workplace and politics, where the very fact that laws and policies, such as affirmative action, are still in place in order for women to try and aspire to be on the same par as their male counterparts. The very fact that women on average still earn less than men in the workplace is a testament to the patriarchal structures that exist today. Moreover, gender discrimination and glass ceilings are very much still alive within Western societies, as are domestic violence and abuse of women, 2 centuries after the call for gender equality arose. Now, given the patriarchal structures that dominate today, it is clear that the West oppresses their own women and seek to do the same with Muslim women. Despite the work, the tireless work of feminist movements that gave women their rights, such as matters pertaining to marriage and the right to vote and to an education, not much has changed to achieve what is their ultimate goal, that being complete equality between the sexes. Now, this concept of gender equality is ironic, given that it is in and of itself a patriarchal concept, for it places the man as the figurehead or goal that the women aspires to reach. Over the generations, many Western feminists have accepted that it brings its own set of contradictions and dilemmas. For example, the dilemma of how a woman can call for equality, which negates the relevance of gender in public life, but at the same time call for pregnancy or maternity rights or flexible working hours based on sex difference. The idea of gender equality that erodes the appreciation of sex differences within the workplace and society hinders rather than facilitates the securing of such basic rights and lays open the door to discrimination. The call for gender-neutral laws that do not recognise the obvious differences between the sexes and may actually contribute to injustices against women, with employers expecting the same commitment at work with respect to time and physical activity of women who are pregnant or have young children. In addition, the concept of gender equality that was in theory to produce the woman to have it all, in reality produced the do-it-all woman, who is continued to be burdened by the household responsibilities and now also has to be burdened by the financial maintenance of the family through struggling to maintaining a demanding career. Being changed to the kitchen sink became quickly replaced by being changed to the economic market. A recent article in the UK newspaper, The Telegraph, with the headline, "Women are doing it all, not having it all," outlined the struggle that modern women are facing having to juggle family life and their careers. The poll conducted with over 5,000 women mothers aged between 20 to 70 years old said they did not have high hopes for the next generation, with 80% admitting that their daughters' lives would be much worse. To further illustrate and debunk the myth that Muslim women do not play a role in political activism, one only needs to look at the recent uprisings in the Muslim world. Women were, and just as active as men in terms of activism, we saw both men and women taking up in the streets, demanding an end to tyrannical regimes, accounting the rulers for their injustices they inflicted on them for many, many years. This is not a recent phenomenon. It was the case at the time of the Prophet, and was always the case in throughout the history of Islam, and is certainly the case in the Islamic revivalist efforts that we see today. A recent conference held this year in Tunisia, who recently shed herself of the old dictatorial regime of Ben Ali, was organised by the women's chapter of the once banned political party Hizbullah Tahrir. Over 1,000 women convened to demand the imposition of Islami law and to have Sharia rule applied in politics. To further emphasise this point, a recent poll conducted by Gallup, of the Gallup poll, was conducted in 5 Arab countries after their respective revolutions and found that women were just as likely as men in their desire to see Sharia law as a source of law implemented in society. This shows that despite the West's call that Muslim women need to be liberated and emancipated, Muslim women want and call for their liberation from the shackles of man-made laws to that which is Sharia. Not the Western alternative of liberation that in reality enslaves them to a fixed patriarchal system. Now, matters in Islam are not defined by gender, or race, or class, for that matter. Rather, Islam looks at the needs of the man and woman as human beings first and foremost, and does what is best for the family life and community as a whole to achieve harmony. Islam afforded men and women the same rights in matters such as the rights to citizenship, including access to justice, the right to vote for a leader and of the state, and having a political voice in society. Islam recognises the differences between genders and addresses their needs accordingly. For example, it defines the responsibility of the man as the breadwinner to his family, and the responsibility of the woman as a homemaker and the nurturer of their children. This is clearly set out in Islam, but at the same time it does not anyway strip the woman, of the ability to participate in employment if she chooses. One would be naive to think that Islam would exclude women from this sphere, but it must be noted that because her primary role is that of a nurturer, all steps will be taken first, with the support of the state, to ensure that her main responsibility is fulfilled without it being compromised in any way. I would also like to add here that as opposed to Western society where the woman takes up employment, her earnings is usually distributed along with the man's earnings into covering household expenses from day-to-day bills. In Islam, her wealth gained from work or inheritance is her own to be spent as she wishes, with no obligation to finance her family's needs. The man, however, is obliged to spend his earnings and inheritance to not only financially maintain his wife and children, but other female relatives if need be. Both men and women in Islam are enjoined with the same responsibilities to raise the word of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, enjoin the good and forbid the evil, and at the same time, Islam recognises the given realities in order to fulfil such tasks. Under secular liberalism, both men and women are oppressed, be it economically, socially and politically. Their worth is not determined by the goodness of their character, but how much they can contribute and feed the hungry capitalist machine. Be it from the pressure to maintain a certain way of life, from owning the dream home and being a slave to the mortgage for the next 30 years, then that in itself puts enormous financial pressure on the family and forces the mother, who would rather be at home with her children, into the workforce. Less time is spent with the family, with children being at childcare for at least 8 hours being the norm, and familial roles being compromised and even negated so as to conform to these sets of conditions. In Islam, the worth of the individual is measured by the Creator alone and not dictated by the standards set upon themselves by man. Both men and women have the same standard in Islam, and this has been outlined clearly in order for us to attain the felicity of our Creator. In the Quran, in Surah Al-Ansar, verse 35, Allah states that the key to success, and addresses both men and women when he says, "Indeed, the Muslim men and women, the believing men and the believing women, the obedient men and obedient women, the truthful men and truthful women, the patient men and patient women, the humble men and humble women, the charitable men and charitable women, the fasting men and the fasting women, the women who guard their private parts and the men who also do, and the men who remember Allah often, and the women who do so, for them, Allah has prepared forgiveness and a great reward indeed." We need to deconstruct Western notions of feminism today, as it does nothing to further the cause of women, both here in the West and in the Muslim world. Instead, a woman will forever be chasing her tail with the false hope that men and women can achieve total gender equality. This is a Western construct that has no place in Islam, and these hang-ups about the battle of the sexes serve only to perpetuate and serve the interests of the patriarchal structures. It is a Western construct born out of the fact that women were seen as being inadequate to men, and the feminist movements born out of this worldview serve and are still trying to rectify this gender imbalance. Muslim women do not share this worldview, and are confident that through Islam and only Islam can we solve the problems that plague the Muslim world today. In conclusion, it is because of secular Western ideology that permeates in all facets of society, whether it be politically, economically, militarily, and socially, that both men and women are suffering from the world over. A comprehensive and radical alternative needs to be put forward, and I can confidently say that this alternative system is being pushed for, and Muslims, both men and women, are working day and night for this change in order for it to become a viable reality.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Podcasts on current events, Islamic guidance, Quran tafsir, and seerah are available at islampodcasts.com, as well as on iTunes. Rate, review, and comment, and let us know how we can grow in our knowledge to better serve our community. Please subscribe, share, and tell a friend about islampodcasts.com.